Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us this morning students from Baraboo High School. Would those students please stand? Good having you with us. You may be seated. We also have with us students from Wisconsin Heights High School. Would those students stand? And it's good seeing you, a familiar face of your instructor. Please be seated. The students are with us with our Court with Class program that's sponsored by the State Bar and the Wisconsin Supreme Court. It's a national award-winning program that brings students who've been invited to the court, and they've accepted our invitation. These students have received briefs in the cases and may have looked to other materials or individuals to learn more about the case. They'll listen to oral argument. Hopefully they will be find it instructive and interesting. And then at noon, the students will meet with the justice of the court for a discussion about the procedures that this court uses in processing cases. There will be no discussion of the substance of the cases we are about to hear. Anyone else is also invited to come and participate at noon in these discussions. It's not limited to the students. We've met you. Let me introduce the court. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. And to my immediate right is Justice John Wilcox, and he's the justice with whom you'll meet at noon. And to Justice Wilcox's right is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far right is Justice Diane Sykes. And when I start on the far left, there's an empty chair. Ordinarily, the newest justice and this year it's Justice Patience Robensack sits there. Justice Robensack will not sit on the first case. She was a member of the panel at the Court of Appeals that heard the case and therefore is not able to sit. And next to the empty chair is Justice David Prosser. And to my immediate left and next to Justice Prosser is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. With those introductions made, I'll call our first case, which is 02-1540-CR, State v. Kiles. Arguing for the state is Assistant Attorney General Stephen W. Kleinmeier.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Kleinmeier, Assistant Attorney General, appearing on behalf of the State of Wisconsin, which is the plaintiff appellant petitioner in this case. We're here to review a decision of the Court of Appeals that affirmed a trial court order suppressing evidence that was obtained as a result of a frisk of Mr. Kiles. The trial court said that it would have found the frisk valid if it could rule on its own, but it felt bound by the decision in State versus Moore to find that the frisk was invalid. The Court of Appeals, in reliance on the Moore decision, affirmed the decision of the trial court granting the suppression motion. And it's because both courts, especially the trial court, relied so heavily on Moore that the state is asking this court to overrule Moore and to find that the frisk in this case was valid. To very briefly summarize the facts, Kyle was a passenger in a car that was stopped for a traffic violation. 3 to 5 minutes after the stop, a second police officer, Officer Vera, came on the scene to assist the first officer. The first officer got consent from the driver to search the car. Officer Rivera asked Mr. Kiles to get out of the car for the search, and after he got out of the car, according to the officer, Mr. Kiles put his hands in his pockets and said he would like to, looking like he'd like to keep them there. The officer told him to take his hands out of his pockets. Mr. Kiles did so, but then he put his hands back in his pockets. The officer again told him to take his hands out of his pockets, and at that point, did a frisk him because the officer said he was thought there might be a weapon there. Another important factor here, I think, is that the coat, this was in January, I think 2001, but it's January anyway, and Mr. Kyles was wearing a heavy, fluffy down coat, as described by the officer, and said he couldn't, officer couldn't see if there were any bulges or anything in the jacket because of the fluffiness of the coat. Now, the trial court said he thought that the officer, that the defendant, Mr. Kyles, putting his hands in his pockets repeatedly would have given the officer reason to believe there was a weapon there. But the court also said that the officer had said he didn't actually feel threatened. And on those two factors, the trial court felt that the decision in Moore required it to grant the suppression motion.
Do you think the decision in Moore required him to grant the suppression motion?
Well, certainly, I'll admit that the case of the facts are close. One thing we don't know from the facts of our case that to compare to Moore, in Moore, the frisk took place about 25 minutes after the initial traffic stop. In this case, it's not clear exactly how long after the initial traffic stop. The first officer said he arrived 3 to 5 minutes after this car had been stopped, and then he said after there was consent to search the car, Mr. Kyles got out of the car, and the frisk was just a few seconds after that. What we don't know is the time, for sure, is the time period from when Officer Rivera arrived until Kyles got out of the car. Now, that time period may have been a way to distinguish the cases. And I actually tried to make an argument on that in the Court of Appeals, but it wasn't real strong.
It's interesting that in response to my question about Moore, you go to the facts. I expect you to go to the law in Moore, because you're asking us to reverse it. So we can't reverse the facts in Moore. So why do you think, if you do, that Moore can or cannot be relied on the law in this case?
Okay. The reason I went to the facts is you said in terms of the trial court. The trial court relied heavily on the facts. I think that the two parts of Moore that legally are wrong are, in Moore, the court looked to the officers, whether the officer subjectively feared, actually had had emotional reaction, a fear of the people in the car in that case. And I think that's the emotional reaction is wrong. You don't look at the officer subjective, whether the officer subjectively feared the person. And also, I think because that was factored in, the court and Moore also felt that the person who refused to remove his hands from his pockets when ordered to do so by the officer did not provide reasonable suspicion to believe that the person was armed.
So if your brief, as I read it, asks us really, and you said that here in oral argument, to overturn Moore, so what exact language in Moore do you want us to withdraw? I mean, we can't reverse Moore.
No, correct it
maybe
a better word.
What language do you want us to withdraw? And before we continue, did Moore at all indicate that it was using an objective test? I mean, that's your real issue here.
It said it was using an objective test, and I think it stated the correct test, but I think it applied the test incorrectly.
Okay. So how do we do that? So what language do you want us to withdraw?
Well, in Moore, I guess it's better look at the opinion itself. In Moore, in paragraph 16, the court said it was the officer was not concerned for his safety when he initially made the traffic stop because he did not order the passengers out, nor was he concerned about his safety when he left the vehicle and his passengers unattended while spending 20 minutes with the driver. I think it's this reference to what the officer was concerned about, because that type of concern, whether he had a subjective fear, shouldn't be a factor here.
And let me just ask you a question. Suppose this had said that the officer did have a subjective fear of his being harmed by a weapon. Would we strike that, too?
Well, it wouldn't establish a frisk. I mean, if there weren't other reasons to justify the frisk. Okay, well,
you want us to withdraw this language because of subjective fear. I'm asking you if the lack of subjective fear, if the officer said he was scared to death, would we withdraw that language too?
That, since we're supposed to apply an objective test, that would not necessarily help establish the test.
But you want us to withdraw that language, too?
Well, yeah, because it wouldn't help establish whether the frisk was valid.
Good.
And what we want to do is know what factors to look at whether a frisk is valid. Whether he has subjective fear or not, it doesn't help that.
Okay, suppose, do you ask him what his training was? Is that subjective or objective?
That's, this court and the United States Supreme Court has recognized that training and experience are part of the objective facts.
Part of the objective facts, although it's personal to that officer.
It's personal to the officer, but it's a fact, goes more, it's more of a fact than an emotion. Fear is an emotion.
So many of these cases obviously are fact-driven. And I was just thinking, well, if you withdraw that language, I'm talking about the subjective considerations, and we look at this, most of these cases we look in the totality of the circumstances, the whole situation, or what really happened out there. And I was thinking it would make a difference if you had a large, bulky, big, fluffy coat on in the winter, and the officer, whether you're worried about weapons, and then in the summer, you have skin-tight blue jeans with a, you know, just a different situation. So there would be, I'm talking about the facts of the officer's concern when you get this person out of the vehicle and you observe them, time of day, night, 3 in the morning, 3 in the afternoon, certainly makes a difference. So what you're telling us is that you would like us to remove that any subjective considerations of the officer should be out.
Yeah, and I guess we have to be careful, I guess, how we use the word subjective, and I'm using it in terms of the emotion, which is fear. If you're talking about something that's personal to him, well, his own training and experience can be personal, but that's recognizes more of, as U.S. Supreme Court Senator Nellis, the background facts against which he analyzes the prince fact.
I was just thinking if an officer who had been on 10 years and had a very bad situation with a person in a bulky coat or, you know, 3 years before and was, you know, all these things can make the difference on what happened on that particular evening or afternoon. The facts are very important. All we're asking, or I think the chief is suggesting, that if that's the language you want removed, it's because you don't want to have to consider whether this officer was afraid and that officer said, I've never been afraid in 23 years.
Correct. Right.
Now, if he has had an experience with a bulky coat, was that, and that makes him afraid, does it come in under subjective or experience?
It would have to be help as far as the training experience and how that helps him, you know, infer with the current facts. I mean,
The defendant can ask him, how many times have you had a bulky coat? And he'll say, all the time in the winter. And then, do you experience so that the people with bulky coats have weapons? He would answer no, and that would be okay.
Well, see, I don't know. We're not relying on a coat alone here, certainly. I think the coat...
No, I'm just asking you, just on that.
Well, I think just because he sees one person with a bulky coat, that it would be hard to say then that all people have bulky coats.
Okay, so the answer to my one bad experience that Justice Wilcox said is you'd strike that.
If that was the only thing he had, I think probably so. But here, I think the two significant factors here, I think, the coat, which could be concealing a weapon that wouldn't be seen, and his refusal or his repeatedly putting his hands in the pockets where a weapon could be. Moore is the only case that's been cited where that was found.
Where in the record do we deal with repeatedly putting hands in the coat?
Pages 15 and 16 of the transcript. This is document 35.
That's what I was going to ask you. Okay. I think Justice Prosser has a question.
I will have. Well, all right. I would, all of the facts, the totality of the facts of the case relate to the test of what the officer is focusing on before to justify a pat-down search. What is the test?
It's, well, whether in this McGill, it was whether a reasonable suspicion, if the officer needs a reasonable suspicion that the suspect is armed, court said it's an objective test. The standard is whether a reasonably prudent man in the circumstances would be warranted in the belief that his safety and that of others was in danger. And here I think when a person puts his hand, keeps putting his hands back in the pockets after he's told to keep them out, and it's a place where a weapon could be concealed, I think a reasonably prudent person is warned in believing his safety is in danger.
That was in 48 seconds, apparently. That's what happened between the 48 seconds when you told him to...
Your Honor, I think that 48...
48 here.
Your Honor, I think 48. That 48 appears only once. Other times it's 4 to 8.
Okay. So in 4 to 8 seconds... Here it says 48.
Yeah, I understand that. But another, I've taken time from that, but in other places it says 4 to 8. And that's.
So you tell him to take it out, he'd take it out, yes. It's inaudible. He was like a nervous habit. He'd put them in, take them out, put them back in, take them out. When I asked him to step out, he immediately put his hands in the pockets. I said, keep your hands out of the pocket. I escorted him. When he reached the fender, I told him to take his hands out of his pocket again, and he cooperated. He was cooperative in stepping out of the car? Yes. He didn't try to flee or walk away from you. Is that correct? He was looking around. He didn't try or flee away or walk away? No, he didn't. He wasn't acting in any kind of boisterous manner? No. He was basically, you had characterized him as being nervous? Yes. And it's common for people to act nervously when pulled over by the police. Don't you agree? I would agree. And now you said it was dark area. 60th is the street, et cetera. That's the end of the hands in and out. 4 to 8 seconds.
There's other parts, too, but this is the one that especially points out that from 15 to 16, they told him to take them out, and then he put them back in. He said he told him that at the top of 16, he told him to take the hand out of his pockets again, and he cooperated. So he's told at least twice to take them. He had to tell him at least twice to take them out.
Okay.
So that's
well,
the basis for
December,
saying.
It is December 23rd. It is 8:45 at night. I think it's not unreasonable to draw the inference that it could have been cold out.
Yes. But first of all, we don't have to eliminate, for reasonable suspicion, we don't have to eliminate innocent conduct. And if this is simply a matter of, I think we'd have a harder time trying to establish reasonable suspicion if we had facts where he got out of the car, initially put his hands in, the officer told him to take them out, and he kept them out, then that may be at least indicate, support more of the idea that maybe it just was cold. But when he puts them back in after being told to keep them out, I think that is a crucial part of this case. And that seemed to come up in all the cases we've cited in our brief, where just about all of them, sometimes it was just the person keeping his hands in his pockets and just moving towards his pocket the first time that was enough. But in many of those cases, there was a situation where the person either refused to remove his hands from his pockets or put them back in after being told to take them out, that the court cited as provided the reasonable suspicion and the concern for the weapons.
He started this conversation by saying what you want changed and more. And you said two things. One, that the court should not ask the officer what the subjective fear or lack thereof is.
Correct.
Those are off the table, right?
Right.
And the second thing you said is that more could be read, as I understand you, to mean that that not removing your hands from your pockets is a does not give rise to a reasonable suspicion.
Yes, that's the way the trial court read it.
So what you want this court to say is failure to remove hands from pocket is one circumstance, depending on the others, that can be considered.
Yes.
No more, no less.
Well, in this book, let me put this in a little bit of my answer, a little bit of context. Mr. Kyle's accused the state of asking for a per se rule. We're not asking for a per se rule. I hear that in almost every case I'm in. What we're asking for is the court to recognize that the facts in this case satisfy reasonable suspicion. Some of the two most crucial facts in this case, I think, were the coat, which could easily conceal a weapon, and the most putting the hands in the pocket and putting them back in after being told not, into a pocket that could conceal it.
So the two best, well, what about dark? It was dark.
Well, Your Honor, I think if this occurred at noon on a bright, sunny day and you had the coat and putting the hands back in, you'd still have reasonable suspicion.
All right. What about night?
Well, I guess that is, Mr. Kyles points out, in this case particularly, that's the same as dark, and that helps, but I think the crucial ones.
What about activities? Pretty?
Pretty active, he said.
Pretty active. Well, okay, what was the question?
Pardon?
What was the question?
I think it was like, how would you describe the criminal activity in this area? I think he said pretty active. I think I'm close on that. Again, I think that's somewhat of a factor. But as I said, I think if this was in a good neighborhood in the middle of the day, and he was wearing his fluffy coat and kept putting his hands back in, those two are the main factors that would do it.
Counsel, you wanted to make clear that you were not asking for a per se rule.
Right.
But it sounds to me that you are. However, the per se rule has two elements, not one. The defense is asserting that you're asking for a bright line rule, that if a person puts their hands in their pockets and out, and in and out, the defense is characterizing you as requesting as that is a bright line rule. But in response to the chief's questions, you continuously have responded, there's only two things, the coat and the hands in and out of the pocket after being told no. And so it seems to me, as I hear your response, you are arguing for a bright line rule. You said it if at noon, it would still be reasonably, there would still be reasonable suspicion, inquiry regarding high crime area. You said even it was a nice neighborhood, based on the coat and hands in and out of the pocket, there'd still be reasonable suspicion. So, boy, tell me why you're not arguing for a bright line rule, or my interpretation is incorrect. Responses you just gave.
Let me read briefly from the decision of Ornelas versus United States. And I think, because I think there's a paragraph here that basically explains what my position.
Counsel, I don't want to interrupt you. Please do read, but I want to make sure you end the response by letting me know if you're asking for a bright line rule.
No, this explains the kind of situation. I view this as precedent, not a bright line rule. In Ornelas, the question was, what's the standard of review for reasonable suspicion and probable cause cases? They said it's de novo review. And explaining why de novo review is appropriate, the court said, and this is in 517 U.S. at pages 697 to 698. It says, finally, de novo review tends to unify precedent and will come closer to providing law enforcement officers with a defined set of rules, which in most instances makes it possible to reach a correct determination beforehand as to whether an invasion of privacy is justified in the interest of law enforcement. And going down the next paragraph on page 698, it is true that because the mosaic which is analyzed for reasonable suspicion or probable cause inquiry is multifaceted, one determination will seldom be a useful precedent for another. But there are exceptions. And then the court goes through some cases where it says, for instance, the circumstances in Brinegar and Carroll versus the United States were so alike that we concluded that reversing the circuit court's decision in Brinegar was necessary to be faithful to Carroll. And it cites some other cases where one case was so similar to another that the second case followed the first. And the way I look at it is, when I'm talking about the coat and the hands in the pocket, it's also in the context of this stop of the car and the search. What I've said is the other factors of time of day, darkness, pretty active crime area, and even Kyle's nervousness to some extent, those factors aren't so important. But
well,
if this...
I want to push you on this because I heard the responses differently. I heard you saying even at noon it would still be reasonably suspicious, and even at the nice neighborhood it would still be reasonably suspicious. Let me frame the question differently. When a defendant or suspect has a heavy coat and he puts his hands in and out repeatedly, in and out of the pockets of that coat after being told no, even if it's at noon, even if it's in a nice neighborhood, Does that constitute reasonable suspicion?
In a traffic stop like this, where the other facts are the same, yes. This case would be precedent that those facts are sufficient to satisfy the reasonable suspicion standard. The reason I don't like using the word per se rule is
because it sounds bad.
Well, in Richards versus all what the courts have recognized is that those facts satisfy reasonable suspicion. And when you have those facts, you're going to satisfy it. A per se rule is like Maryland versus Wilson, the rule in Richards versus Wisconsin, where the courts, even if the circumstances don't show any danger, the rule permits the police to do something. In Maryland versus Wilson, they said it's a per se rule. They can order people out of the car every time for no reason at all, just because sometimes there's danger. Well, I'm not asking that every time a person puts his hands in his pockets that that's enough. Justice Wilcox gave the example of in the summertime, someone's wearing some tight jeans. Now, if those jeans are tight enough that any weapon would be outlawed.
What about a razor blade? A razor blade.
These are real tight jeans.
All I'm saying, there are circumstances when it may not be shown. But when you have something identical to this or very close to it, as Ornelas says, what you have is precedent, that those kind of facts satisfy reasonable suspicion.
How about the summertime, nice day, nice neighborhood, and in addition to the tight jeans, has a blue jean jacket with pockets in, and hands go in and out of the pocket. Does that constitute reasonable suspicion?
Well, if I think the jacket probably would show this, that the weapon could be concealed without, you know, without an outline being seen and stuff, then I think the cop, the officer probably had the same concerns. That they would be, as Ornella says, it sounds like facts so similar, it would be very difficult to distinguish.
So in answer to my inquiry, as long as the pockets to the jean jacket were kind of padded enough or bulky enough, that would constitute reasonable suspicion.
I think.
I think probably so. But again, we also have to know, why is the officer having contact with this person? If it's like this,
one headlight's out,
and they get consent to search, and the officer's told.
Wait a minute. Traffic stop. And it's no consent. You've changed the facts.
Okay. Well, if the facts are changed, then I don't know if the result's going to be the same.
We're talking about the pat down. Can you pat down? Can you pat you down in a business suit on a traffic stop where you keep putting your hands in the pocket? In 4 to 8 seconds, I figure out you can probably do it 8 times. I mean, would look like a nervous tick.
Well, Your Honor, as far as the quickness here, you have to.
I think I've just used up 8 seconds.
Yeah, Your Honor, I think you're being a little critical of the quickness here, and I don't know the exact time. But remember, the officer here, he was acting in light of Moore, where an officer was criticized for not acting immediately. So, I mean, and that argument was made by the prosecutor. They tried to distinguish it. But back to the question of.
Can we search you in the business suit if you keep putting your hands in the pocket in 4 to 8 seconds?
I think that sounds like the Ganaway case and probably from Minnesota, and I think they probably could.
It's a per se rule.
Well.
I wouldn't wear a business suit if I were you. As long as
what I won't do is put my hands in my pockets after being told to keep them out. That's the crucial part of this. And that's what gives the officer the fear. I mean, why would there be a person be putting his hands back in the pocket if there's not something to be concerned about?
He's just nervous.
Well, if he's that nervous, that may be also something to be concerned about, too. Although in this case, he claims he wasn't that nervous. But the claims that maybe he was just putting his hands in the pocket, he was. But I think that
the officer described him as nervous. Is that a fact or a subjective evaluation by the judge, by the officer?
No, I think that's considered an objective fact. It's, you know, obviously some analysis involved, but it's still, you have to analyze that.
In the Moore case, the court described the frisk as a general precautionary measure. Is that not a valid test? And if it is not a valid test, why was this frisk not just a general precautionary measure?
I think when they were talking in Moore, my understanding was saying general precautionary measure, they meant it wasn't really, there weren't specific articulable facts for the case. They were just, he's always going to frisk. And I think cases obviously require facts specific enough to show reasonable suspicion. The officer can't just say, I'm in close proximity to someone, therefore I want to frisk. And I think that, and that's why I think that the court said it reached the conclusion of general precautionary, because it looked at the case incorrectly. It said this officer wasn't concerned for 20 minutes, so anything that happened after that doesn't give reasonable suspicion. So if there's not reasonable, you know, you don't have the articulable facts, then the only thing left is just some general precautionary measure. And I think it's because that they looked at that 20 minutes, which I don't know how he would have frisked Moore in the first 20 minutes, because in that case, there's no indication Mr. Moore did anything that would have justified a frisk until, you know, after about 20 or 25 minutes when he kept his hands in his pockets. But it's, I think they said the general precautionary measure, because they discounted the significance of keeping the hands in the pockets and because they factored in this failure to do anything for 20 or 25 minutes.
Now, can I just go back to Moore? You don't have any objection to this language. Having reviewed all the facts and circumstances set forth in the record, we conclude the frisk was unreasonable because the officer could not have objectively thought that Moore was dangerous. Do you have any objection to that language?
That's the conclusion. I object to it because of the way they reached that conclusion.
Just asking if that language would be okay.
I agree. That sounds good, facts, yes.
Okay, it sounds okay. We cannot agree that a reasonably prudent person in the officer's position would believe that his or her safety was in danger. Now, I know you don't agree with the conclusion, but taken outside the facts, that's a good statement of law, isn't it?
Yes.
All right. We conclude that the frisk of Moore was unlawful because the officer lacked reasonable, articulable facts to prove that he believed him to be dangerous. That's good law.
No, because he did have reasonable, articulable facts.
No, I know, but the law.
Well, yeah, the statement. Okay.
All right. I'm just trying to make sure that we're all on the same page as to the law.
It's how they reach that that's our dispute.
Just think that the facts in Moore do not substantiate it, and they don't substantiate it because the Court of Appeals looked at the personal subjective fear aspect.
And because they didn't say that the pocket refusal to remove the hands was sufficient.
All right. Thank you.
An officer must have a reasonable fear for his or her personal safety before effectuating a frisk. Is that good law?
Reasonable in the sense of the facts objectively would show that there's a reason to be concerned about safety and that the person is armed. I think that's what the correct way of interpreting that. Because as this court said in McGill and in the U.S. Supreme Court and ran in a whole bunch of cases where reasonable suspicion and probable cause laws, you view the facts objectively and the officer's subjective motivation does not determine whether it's valid or invalid. So if you're talking about reasonable fear, if they're talking about fear, a concern for safety under the subjective analysis, then I think that would be correct. But I think it has to be read that way, I think.
Objective would be all right, subjective fear not okay.
Right.
Thank you. Because you're equating reasonable fear to reasonable suspicion.
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Eileen Hirsch. I represent Mr. Kyles in this case, and I just want to take a couple seconds to thank you for inviting the high school class from my hometown to today's argument. It makes me feel much more comfortable.
We planned it that way, Ms. Hirsch.
I'm sure you did. I am made uncomfortable by the fact, however, that if the court holds, as the state asks it to today, that when I leave this courtroom and walk outside in my winter coat, which is hanging out in the hallway with its pockets, and I walk across the street jaywalking, an officer stops me for jaywalking across the street on the Capitol Square in Madison at 11:30 in the morning. If I nervously put my hands in my pockets of my coat after the officer tells me not to do so, that gives the officer reasonable grounds to frisk me there on the street on the Capitol Square in Madison.
Well,
I don't think the court wants to go that way.
I'm not so sure the court shouldn't go there. We don't know, and an officer doesn't know, who has a concealed weapon, right? Weapon can be a boxcar, whatever they call it, which is a razor blade. Mm-hmm. It can be a gun. It can be a knife, right? And
traffic stops are dangerous. Any stop of a citizen or any stop of a non-citizen is potentially dangerous. We agree on that?
That's correct.
All right. And we don't want officers and we don't want people hurt. Right? We agree on that.
Right.
And you are told to take your hands out of the pocket, which is a good warning for that officer for safety. And you don't do it. Now, that's not quite the fact situation here. You do take them out. You put them back. You take them out. You put them back. Okay. Why isn't that an indicia that the officer should have reasonable suspicion that you are armed? I mean, that's the test, isn't it?
The test is the totality of the circumstances. Okay. And I agree that within that totality test, putting one's hands in one's pockets is a factor to be considered.
Okay. All right. So we got that on the table. It's a factor.
Right. Okay. Can I just say, just let me expand on it very briefly, though, because I think there's one minor point here, which is that when you read the cases about hands in pockets, there's lots of different ways people do it. They do it as a nervous habit, which is what was said in this case. They do it as a furtive gesture. The court in this case said that this was not a furtive gesture. And that's when, you know, there's a case where somebody answers the door using the left hand with the right hand stuffed in his pocket when the police come to the door. And that's a furtive gesture. There's an indication there that he's acting unusually in a way that raises suspicion. Another way that people can put their hands in their pockets is to make a sudden movement toward a pocket. There are differences within this. And actually, in this case, there's a difference. Mr. Moore stubbornly refused to take his hands out of his pockets. Mr. Kyles complied with the officer's direction, but then nervously put them back in. So there's so many ways in which somebody can put their hands in their pockets that I think to make the rule asked for by the state, again, causes more questions.
Well, what's the rule asked for by the state? The rule I hear is that someone keeps the hands in the pocket. That is one factor. Now, if the judge says, well, it's not furtive, it's nervous, okay, and discounts it, I guess the state would agree with that. We can ask them that.
Mm-hmm. But as I hear the state today, they didn't agree that it was simply a factor. And I actually wrote down their request on page 9 of their reply brief, and I think it's exactly what the state said today. It says the requirement for specific and articulable facts providing reasonable suspicion in the particular case is satisfied when a person fails to comply with a police order to keep his hands out of pockets that could be concealing a weapon. I think that's the same thing he said today. And that applies in every neighborhood, in every lighting condition, in every circumstance. I want to mention also two things. One is on a factual basis. I think that we have consistently in this argument so far overlooked the fact that Mr. Kyles was never suspected of being involved in criminal activity. He was stopped as a passenger in a car that didn't have its headlights on. It's a $10 forfeiture offense. The officer asked for consent to search the car. The driver gave it. But the officer specifically testified that he had no reason to believe that either the driver or Mr. Kyles was involved in criminal activity. Now, if we go back to the beginnings of the Frisk rule in the United States, it's Terry versus Ohio. And in Terry versus Ohio, the officer was investigating what looked very much like a robbery, a violent criminal act. And in that case, the court said that it had to balance the intrusion of a frisk against the police interest in safety. The liberty interest in a frisk is very different than the liberty interest the court has recently considered in both Mims versus Pennsylvania and Maryland versus Wilson. Both of those cases involved asking a driver or a passenger to simply get out of a car. And in those cases, the court held that the liberty interest was relatively minimal after the car had been stopped and they were there with the police. However, in Terry versus Ohio, the court said, and I'm going to quote from Terry, that a frisk constitutes a severe, though brief, intrusion upon cherished personal security. and it must surely be an annoying, frightening, and perhaps humiliating experience. You put that on one side of the equation. You put the police interest and safety on the other side of the equation. My view is that if the police are there to investigate a crime, if they're protecting public safety, then the police safety has more weight than if they are simply satisfying their curiosity with a consent search of a car. That if they cannot protect their safety without doing frisks, when they walk up to me on the street and ask me if they could ask me a few questions, then they shouldn't be walking up to me on the street. This court needs to put parameters on police action and say you cannot initiate an encounter with a citizen with no reasonable suspicion that that citizen's involved in any criminal activity. And then once you've initiated that encounter, use a nervous gesture as a reason to infringe upon that citizen's personal liberty, to actually put your hands on them and run them up and down them.
Could I ask you, does that apply at an airport?
An airport, you know, I think that we're all used to these metal detectors you go through at the airport. And I have always walked through metal detectors. I did it here in the state capitol for a while, and I do when I go to courthouses. Walking through a metal detector, having somebody take a wand and wave it around you, it is embarrassing and humiliating. That wand thing, I just recently did that at the court, having to take your, at the airport, taking your shoes off. It's embarrassing. But it is not actually someone putting their hands on you, running them up between your legs and into your armpits, looking for weapons.
Well, frankly, right after 9/11, people who wanted to get into this building, even if they were much younger than these students here, had their lunch pails gone through.
Exactly. It's personal. It's property. I went through it, too. They went through my briefcase. You know, we're used to that. We know that. But the standard is set in Terry for a frisk. And nothing that I know of going into airports or courthouses is the intrusion that was set forth in Terry versus Ohio, the kind of frisk risk.
But let me ask you, is the law exactly the same irrespective of where the frisk is conducted?
I don't know that I know of any distinction. I'm not sure what you're getting at.
Let's say it's in West Bend, Wisconsin, or versus 60th Street with the intersection of 30th Avenue in Kenosha.
Okay. Well, location matters in one sense, and that sense was the case of Morgan versus State, which was if it's in a high crime area, the court has recognized that if the police fear is heightened because of the nature of the neighborhood, and I honestly don't, 60th Street in Kenosha is not a high crime area as far as I can tell. There's certainly no evidence that it is.
The testimony is otherwise.
No, it isn't. The testimony is when the officer was asked, what was the level of criminal activity in that area, he said, quote, pretty active. That's all he said, was pretty active. The judge did not draw an inference that that meant high crime. And as I argue in my brief, pretty active is a pretty ambiguous term. The judge didn't draw any inference from that term about whether it was high crime or low crime. And of course, although the standard in this court is de novo, the standard with regard to facts found or not found by the trial judge gives deference to the trial judge's findings. And so I think that we have to, in terms of this neighborhood versus the Capitol Square, I don't think that we can argue any difference. And truthfully, if you ask police whether the Capitol Square was a pretty active crime area, they'd probably say yes.
So give me the standard that you want us to use. You've talked about the standard you're saying is Terry versus Ohio, and that's it, and it makes no difference. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what is the standard you want this court to use?
The standard I want the court to use is to reaffirm the standard of Terry versus Ohio.
Just spell that out.
And the standard that I take from Terry versus Ohio is specific and articulable facts which, under the totality of the circumstances, would cause a reasonably prudent person in the officer's position to believe that the person, the whatever you want to call him, the suspect or whatever, was armed and dangerous.
Now, how does that differ from the test in Moore?
I don't think it does. I think it is the test in Moore.
Okay.
But
now,
isn't
this fight really about Moore?
Well, I think it must be. I think this was a very routine suppression decision by a very experienced trial judge. I don't think the trial judges need a lot of rules, that they're used to weighing the totality of the circumstances. They know the practices of their communities. And this judge weighed the totality of the circumstances, and he said he did.
But he also said language that I think can be interpreted, that he read Moore to mean subjective fear. And if he got rid of, and if the, there was no subjective fear on the part of the police officer, we don't have a good Terry stop. Now, if that's what the judge thought, would that be correct law?
If the judge thought that, no, it wouldn't be correct law. I agree.
All right. So you agree with the state that the subjective fear or the subjective lack of fear is not a relevant consideration.
I agree with the state that it doesn't control, that's not the final decision. I think where I disagree with the state is really just sort of a realistic view. If you read Moore, for example, if you read other decisions of the courts, the officer's testimony, the officer says, I searched him for officer safety, very common, we see it all the time. I think the courts have to consider that. I think they have to think about that and to weigh the facts against that officer's testimony. And so to say that it can't even be mentioned in the decision, can't even be considered by the court, I don't think is the right standard. And as I read Moore, you could take out those two sentences the state doesn't like in Moore. It doesn't change the holding of the decision, of the case. But as I read those sentences, what they're saying is, we can't find any reason to suspect this guy, Mr. Moore, of being armed and dangerous, but the officer keeps saying he did it for officer safety. So we try to look at that. We try to look critically at this testimony of the officer because we recognize that this is an important interest, and we try to weigh it against the facts. And when they say that, they say, well, look, he didn't seem to have any problems with his safety at the beginning of the search, and there was no suspicious incidents, or beginning of the stop, and there were no suspicious incidents during the beginning of the stop. So given that background, we have a nice background of 20, 25 minutes. The police are there. They're working with the people in the car. Mr. Moore's sitting there quietly. And then he, 25 minutes later, puts his hands in his pockets and says, I'm not taking him out. I want to walk home. And the court says, in that circumstance, where you're weighing the first circumstances, the first part of the search versus what he did then, that they didn't find any reasonable, articulable grounds justifying a frisk of Mr. Moore. And so I think that what I don't agree with, and I think courts, if you read the decisions and just sort of peruse them, you'll see that they're constantly talking about the officer's testimony, the officer's perception of safety. But what they're doing is weighing it against the facts specific to the person they want us, they're frisking, about whether there are reasonable and articulable reasons, objective reasons, to support the officer's decision that this person was armed and dangerous.
I have another question slightly off this particular topic. We look at the testimony at the preliminary hearing, right? I'm sorry, not the preliminary.
At the suppression motion. That's correct.
What else can we look at? There's a motion here. There are attachments to the motion. The attachments, I think, are the police reports. Can we find reasonable suspicion in the police reports? I mean, not in this case. I want to know if we can use that.
As far as I know, you can't.
Why not?
Because they haven't been tested by testimony in the court. I didn't research that question for today's argument, so I can't give you a definitive answer, but my understanding is that the purpose of having police officers come in and testify at suppression hearings is that you can ask them the questions on cross-examination that test the facts that they're testifying to, and you can make sure that the police report, whatever they've said in the report, may or may not be accurate. They may say, oops, that was a mistake, and the judge can judge the credibility of the various people who testify at the suppression hearing. None of that happens in a written police report.
Were the police reports introduced in evidence?
Not that I know of, no.
Just attached to the motion.
I guess they were attached to the motion. Truthfully, I haven't even reviewed the police reports for purposes of this argument at any level in this briefing this case, because we focused only on the testimony at the hearing.
But could I ask a similar question to the Chief Justice? I don't recall reading any testimony about the age of Mr. Kiles or any physical description of Mr. Kiles. May we take into account his age or physical description?
I don't know his age or physical description either, except from I know his physical description because I've met him, but I don't think that those are relevant to the to this decision in this case, unless there are some cases where it has come into testimony, where there's been testimony at the suppression hearing that the person was very large and, you know, physically intimidating. But that was not a factor relied upon by the state in this case to justify the frisk of Mr. Kiles.
Suppose he was small. A gun in a small person's hand or a knife may be just as dangerous.
Just as dangerous. That's correct, Your Honor.
Right. And you make a, I think it was this case, I sometimes get confused with the next case, that in when there's been an altercation with an officer in a traffic stop, most of the time, in the 90%, it's with fists and hands, not with weapons.
That's correct. That's mentioned in a footnote in my brief, that less than 8% of assaults on officers in Wisconsin have come from traffic stops, and 93.9% of those involve fists and hands. So
that's why size might be important for fists or hands.
I suppose so. Obviously, the parties in this case did not think it was relevant, or that would have come in either from the defense or from the prosecution at the suppression hearing.
That would have been part of the objective standards. Tests.
Correct. And I think, again, the court, even though this is a de novo review, the court is bound to the facts that the trial court found, or the facts that supported and the inferences that supported the trial court's finding in this case. And so to pull facts that were not part of the record into this decision really is not respecting that standard of review.
Ms. Hirsch, let me explore that a little bit. You just indicated it's a de novo review, and of course it is, in regard to the application of the constitutional principles to the facts.
Correct.
Now, you seem to be telling us that in this case, as an example, we have a notice of motion, a motion, an affidavit, and attached to the affidavit we have, among other things, police reports. You're telling us that we can't consider those police reports in our de novo review?
The de novo review is of the application of the constitutional law as applied to the facts found by the trial court. The standard of review, I think, is fairly well established, that the court must rely upon the facts found by the trial court and the inferences the trial court drew from those facts.
I don't disagree with that.
The trial court in this case drew no facts or inferences from any motions or police reports. Its finding was based on the testimony at the hearing. And so this court is bound by those facts and then applies to the law to those facts.
But certainly the trial court, in the normal course of the situation, would be aware of the motion, the notice of motion, would have reviewed the affidavit, and would have reviewed the documents attached to that affidavit. Can't we draw that inference? What trial judge would come on the bench without having looked at the motion that he or she was about to decide?
Well, I think that the trial, well, I, you know, you were a trial judge, but I rely in my legal practice on the trial judge knowing the theory of the case and the facts that I allege. However, the purpose of a hearing is to test those facts. And if at the conclusion of the hearing the trial judge is not convinced that those facts were true, then the trial judge doesn't make those findings a fact.
But in this case, the trial judge didn't have trouble with the facts. He had trouble with the Moore decision. And he thought the Moore decision dictated the suppression decision he made. Isn't that correct?
I think there's several ways to read. The trial judge was fairly informal in this case and made a number of statements about that. He clearly believed that he was that the Moore decision controlled his decision. However, he also said, and I have it here, well, he said twice, and I have one of them here. On page 27, he said, I grant the motion to suppress because there's no articulable objective information here that there was indications that he was in fact dangerous, as opposed to frisking him for officer safety. And again, he's doing that kind of balancing that they did in Moore. Is officer safety just sort of a general precautionary thing, or were there articulable facts to this case? Earlier, and I don't have the page site right at the top of my head, but the district attorney was arguing to him about Moore and the decision in Moore, and he said to her, I have no articulable facts. I have no reasonable grounds to believe that Mr. Kyles was armed and dangerous. And so on one hand, he's saying, Moore controls, and certainly in a way it does. I mean, it would be hard. In this case, actually, there's less reason to search than there was in Moore. My client wasn't resistive. He didn't refuse to take his hands out of his pockets. It's a bit more reasonable time of night, et cetera. But he says two things. One is, I think Moore controls, but he's also saying, I see no articulable basis for this search. You haven't proved it to me. And so I don't think the court can go outside the record of the hearing to make fact findings. This court can't make fact findings that the trial court didn't make. I want to address real briefly the state. Go ahead.
Sorry, one more question for you. You know, we compare, other than the Moore case, do you have another case that the Supreme Court, this court, has held that the search was should be suppressed because there are no articulable facts? I'd like to sort of compare this case with a case we've had where we suppress the search.
I cannot think of a case. I'll tell you honestly, I limited my research at some point to consent searches of passengers in cars, because I thought the fact that this case did not involve a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity was a crucial fact in the case. I believe that there's a Court of Appeals decision. I think it's State versus Young, but I could be wrong about that citation, where the Court of Appeals held that there was no reasonable grounds for a stop based on the reasonable grounds, not for the frisk.
Did you do a Lexis or Westlaw search on Moore to see whether or not there were other cases, published or unpublished? Maybe this was in a footnote in your case, too.
I didn't footnote it, Your Honor, but I did. And there are two, when I did my shepherdized Moore on Lexis, there were two unpublished decisions, both of which the suppression motion was denied. They cited Moore, but then found that there were reasonable grounds to search.
That's what we have found. Go ahead.
Oh, well, I'm glad I did that right. I do want to mention the state quoted at some length from this Ornelas case about why reviewing courts need to have some standards that kind of pull together and give trial judges guidelines. I want to point out that in United States versus Arvizu, which is cited in the state's reply brief, a 2002 U.S. Supreme Court decision, that argument was made to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court held in Arvizu that reasonable suspicion is a difficult, sometimes kind of messy concept, but we have deliberately avoided reducing it to a neat set of legal rules. And Arvizu, the United States Supreme Court, overruled a Ninth Circuit decision in which the Ninth Circuit tried to clearly delimit consideration of certain factors in the reasonable grounds analysis, and the Supreme Court overturned them and said, we have said repeatedly that courts must look at the totality of the circumstances of each case, and in this case it was a stop, to see whether the detaining officer has a particularized and objective basis for suspecting legal wrongdoing. I submit that the Supreme Court has recently gone on record saying, we will not accept rules or guidelines or any kind of attempt to limit and set forth factors saying these factors are always reasonable suspicion. And when they exist, regardless of the other totality of the circumstances, they do not, the court can find reasonable suspicion.
But counsel, you're not going to say that the court cannot look at keeping hands in the pocket.
No, I would never say that.
Court can look at keeping hands in the pocket.
That's correct.
And under certain circumstances, failure to remove hands from the pocket is going to be good enough, with or without other circumstances, to have a reasonable suspicion.
That's correct. You know,
under other circumstances, you're going to say it can be not a sufficient ground in and of itself or with others to do that.
That's
correct. Is that your position?
Yes. I think I should end then on saying this, that this, the reasonable grounds analysis really requires some common sense application by the trial judge of the law to the facts of the case. And just as in some instances, when the defendant makes a furtive movement toward their pockets, or when there's reasonable suspicion that the defendant is involved in an armed robbery or a murder or some sort of violent crime, that going for the pockets may, in that circumstances, certainly create a reasonable suspicion. I think in our case, you have to look at the fact that going for the pockets of his winter coat, his completely appropriate winter coat, was the only fact that the state had for it to support reasonable grounds to search, to do a frisk of Mr. Kiles. And I think that you cannot underestimate the importance of the fact that Mr. Kiles was suspected of no criminal activity. The first step in the Terry analysis was not there. There was no reason to believe, and the officer testified, I had no reason to believe he was involved in any criminal activity. And so you take what is at that point an innocent citizen, and I don't think you could go from there to saying when he puts his hands in his pockets nervously, that creates a reasonable suspicion to make that severe, humiliating intrusion into his personal liberty. And so I would ask the court in this case to affirm both the trial court and the Court of Appeals, both of whom I believe, and there's no question that the Court of Appeals in this case used an objective standard, both of whom I believe used the objective standard to determine that the officer did not have reasonable grounds in this case.
Could I ask, hypothetically, does it add anything if, in fact, an officer knows that the person being frisked has a criminal record?
I think that depending on the criminal record. But, yes, I mean, if you give me the hypothetical that the officer knows that last week he saw my client in front of a drug house holding a gun, yes, I think that's a reasonable, that the officer can testify to that at the suppression hearing and that that's a factor that can be considered, that he has a history of violence, that he has a history of resisting arrest, that he has a history of concealed weapons charges.
What if he has a history of drugs? History of drug possession or sale?
I think that would depend. Well, first of all, I think that depends on whether the court, I mean, I think it makes, it has, requires this court to take the additional step of finding that drugs and guns are always linked. And I wouldn't make that step. I think that, again, there are so many circumstances. But again, this is something that the officer could testify about, that this could be evidence at the suppression hearing. He has a history of one charge of marijuana possession when he was 18 years old. Does that raise an inference of guns? I think not. If he has, you know, five felony drug convictions for heroin and cocaine, large amounts, maybe, maybe not. I think that the court has to explore that at the suppression hearing in terms of the evidence that goes to the totality of the circumstances. But again, it's the trial judge's province to find those facts. They just don't exist in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Mr. Kleinmeier. Do you know of any case that the court has upheld a suppression that we can sort of compare the facts and circumstances?
Yeah, I was trying to think of that when you asked the question. Offhand, I don't. No.
It would be unfair to say that this court has never seen a search it didn't like.
I'm not going to say that because I can't think of all the cases over the history of the Wisconsin Supreme Court that have looked at this. I think I've probably lost a few myself.
Is that a criticism or just an observation?
It's an observation. It's not subjective. I do want to point out that Mr. Kyles makes an objection to a frisk of a person who is not otherwise suspected of a crime, but we cite at least four cases in our brief where passengers in cars that were stopped for traffic offenses ended up being frisked when they were not otherwise suspected of a crime, and that's United States versus Menard, the United States versus Mitchell, People versus Frank V., and the Laube case. I don't have it here, but L-A-U-B-E. Those have all been cited in our briefs. In Menard, the court pointed out that was also a traffic stop, consent search, consent given by the driver to search the car. People gotten out of the car, and then the passengers were frisked. And the court said, in finding the frisk of Menard, one of the passengers was proper. The court said a police officer who has legitimate contact with another person and who has reason to believe that person may be armed and dangerous may conduct the pat-down. And in this circumstance, there is legitimate contact. And more, one thing we're certainly not objecting to and more, was a statement in paragraph 17 that it's reasonable for an officer to ask a vehicle's passenger to step out of the car to facilitate the search, citing Maryland versus Wilson. And one of the reasons, and for the main reason the court in Maryland versus Wilson said you can ask passengers to get out of the car is there's always a possibility they may be concerned of violence because the person may be concerned about the police finding something in the car. Well, here we have a situation where there's about to be a search. And if Mr. Manure is now, he's getting out of the car, there's going to be a search. And in light of this concern of Maryland versus Wilson, he keeps putting his hands in his pockets. I think the officer has reasonable suspicion to do the frisk. Mr. Kyle's also arguing points to the trial court's comments about no articulable facts. However, that comes because the trial court found that Moore prevented the court from finding reasonable suspicion. And when the way the court was understanding Moore to require the granting the suppression motion, in light of that, the court said, yeah, there's no particular facts to justify it. But I think that trial court's statement of that has to be read in light of its conclusion that Moore was going to require this result. So I think because the court made it clear that otherwise it would have found that the hands in the pockets repeatedly was sufficient to justify the frisk. I think those are the only facts I want to make up.
Could I ask, in the suppression hearing, Officer Rivera testified that I asked if he had anything illegal on him, any weapons or drugs, and at that time he stated no. That's when I told him I was going to conduct a pat-down of him. What is the significance of the question that was asked and answered?
You mean the question that was asked of Mr. Kyles?
Yeah.
I don't think that adds to the reason for a frisk. I mean, in terms of the test, the objective test that has to be satisfied, just because Mr. Kyle says no to that, I don't think that necessarily gives the officer reason. If Mr. Kyles had not been putting his hands in out of his pockets, if there's a consent to search, he gets out of the car, his hands are out of his pockets, and the officer says, do you have anything illegally on, drugs or guns or anything illegal on you? And Mr. Kyle says no. That's not going to, I don't think that would give justification for the frisk.
Counsel, do you agree with the standard of review that your opposing counsel indicated here today?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've agreed in the standard of review that it's give deference to the trial court's finding on historical facts, and there's an overview of, you know, the legal significance of those facts.
In determining whether or not there's a reasonable and articulable suspicion, do you agree that as a reviewing court we are we are to assess that based on the facts and inferences drawn from those facts by the trial court at the hearing and evidence presented at the hearing?
Well, what happens, unfortunately, in a lot of suppression hearings is there's not a very complete finding, you know, findings of facts. The trial court doesn't go through and say, I find this occurs in such and such a time. I find high crime activity or so going on down the line. There's also a standard that in suppression motions, the court is to assume the trial court found facts to support its conclusion. Here we have a situation where the trial court said, well, I would have found there was reasonable suspicion, but Moore says I can't. So that's
Let me maybe refine my question, that as a reviewing court, we assess the legal standard based on the facts and inferences presented into evidence at the hearing.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that goes back to some of these questions about police reports. And I guess I'd like to be able to argue that the court can use that, but I understand they couldn't because, in effect, they weren't subject to cross-examination. They weren't introduced in evidence and questioned about. So I have to agree with Sir Kyle's counsel on that. My understanding is that those, without having been introduced at the suppression hearing, could not be used at this point.
Even though they were attached and before the judge.
Right, because they weren't introduced. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kleinmeier. Thank you, Mr. Hirsch, for very good arguments on a very difficult area in the law that the court keeps facing, namely search and seizures in automobile stops. So thank you very much, and we are going to have another issue on an automobile stop coming up. But in the meantime, we take a break to let the students leave if they want to and allow new students to come in. That's unlike the commercial breaks in the TV court scene.